Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Internal whistleblowers, watch out. That's the message the U.S. Supreme Court seems to be sending. Today, the High Court narrowly ruled against government employees who blow the whistle to colleagues inside the office. The court saying those internal finger pointers are not protected by free speech and could suffer repercussions. Newest Justice Samuel Alito cast the deciding vote in a ruling that came as government investigators look into the leak of an undercover CIA agent's name to the media, as well as classified information about warrantless wiretaps and U.S. secret prisons abroad. Well, joining us on the line is Lyle Dennison, veteran Supreme Court reporter and author of SCOTUS blog on the web. And Lyle, this ruling concerns internal whistleblowers, not leakers to the media. So remind us, it's a case that involves a Los Angeles prosecutor. He claims he was demoted for writing a memo that accused a county sheriff's deputy of lying to obtain a search warrant. But this was an internal memo.
Yes, he did not go out on the public stump, Robin. He wrote a memo inside the office saying we shouldn't go forward with this case because the sheriff's deputy lied, essentially, in getting a search warrant. So this is a bad case. They went ahead with the case anyway. They did not like the memo that he wrote complaining about the prosecution, and so they demoted him.
Now, we understand an appellate court ruling held that his memo was constitutionally protected free speech.
Yes, the appellate court said since this fellow was speaking, even though he was speaking inside the office process, he was speaking on an issue of concern, that is, whether or not the government should be prosecuting somebody based upon flawed evidence. So the lower court said the content of his speech was important to the public, and therefore the First Amendment should apply to him. The Supreme Court said no.
And what were the arguments in the Supreme Court, for and against, because we know it was split?
Well, the basic argument in favor of Richard Ceballos was that, in fact, he was speaking out on an issue that the public was concerned about, that is, flawed criminal prosecution. The government said on the other side, wait a minute, he was not speaking as a citizen on a topic of public concern. He was doing what his job requires him to do, that is, to write internal memos assessing the prosecution, and he shouldn't have any constitutional protection at all. And the Supreme Court bought the latter argument.
Right. And what does this mean? Because, as you said, this was internal, an internal whistleblower. Ironically, if he had potentially gone to the press and complained, would he have been more protected?
It seems quite clear that he would have been, Robin, because the Supreme Court has said if you go out and act like a citizen, that is, you write a letter to the editor or you get on some public forum somewhere and you speak out, if so long as it's an issue that the public generally is concerned about and you're not just complaining because you don't like your boss or your mm-hmm. coworker, so long as you're complaining on an issue of public concern, then you are protected. But it has to be in a forum where a citizen would get protected if the citizen did the same thing. And the court says this fellow wasn't speaking as a citizen inside the office. He was speaking as an employee within the scope of his actual day-to-day duties.
And his employers had a right to demote him because they didn't like his actions.
Yes, though in some cases, I think, Robin, some workers, at least at the local level, will often be protected by internal grievance procedures. In other words, this was only a constitutional decision today. It didn't say that employers couldn't have, perhaps by labor union contracts, some way to protect their employees and give them mm-hmm. some leeway within the office. But this was a constitutional ruling saying they don't get the protection of the national constitution. Hmm.
Well, Lyle Dennison, what does this ruling mean in the wider scope?
Well, I think it's pretty clear, Robin, that what this is going to do is encourage timidity among public employees because, they are now exposed to internal discipline. If the management can say, well, you were speaking out as part of your normal duty assignment, and we can't let you do that. So I think the broader signal that the court seems to be saying today is, whistleblowers, you better watch your step, and you better pick your targets with great care and pick your forums with even greater care, because if you're doing it within the office, you're likely to be in trouble.
Lyle Dennison, author of SCOTUS blog on the web. Lyle, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Always glad to be with you again, Robin.
In Germany, a military spokesman says CBS News correspondent Kimberly Dozier is responsive, moving her toes, and in critical but stable condition after a car bomb exploded next to her yesterday in Baghdad. The bomb killed Kimberly's colleagues, cameraman Paul Douglas and soundman James Brolin, a U.S. soldier, so far unnamed, and an Iraqi interpreter. Well, the casualties underscore the risks faced by everyone in Iraq. NPR's Jamie Tarabay is quite familiar with those risks, and we're going to spend the next few minutes hearing from her. Jamie Tarabay has been covering Iraq since the formal end of hostilities in 2003, and we spoke with her last week while she was here in Boston on a break. In her reporting, she's usually out and about. She gives listeners vivid pictures of what life is like in Iraq, how difficult it is, for instance, to simply buy bread in Baghdad.
The breadline has always been a place where an attack strikes at the heart of the ordinary person. Everyone has to eat. Unemployed Haider Khaled buys bread every day if he can, but not at the same place each time.
I don't know which bakery I should go to, because I don't know which one of them might be targeted. If I stand in the street and a car parks close by, I leave straight away in case it explodes.
A portion of one of Jamie Tarabay's reports from Baghdad. Last week, she joined us in the studio. Now, for security reasons, she couldn't tell us how she travels so extensively in Iraq, but she did tell us where she gets most of her information.
A lot of it is just talking to Iraqis. A lot of it is just finding out what it's like for them every day. We hear different stories about just driving to work, or someone that I know is trying to get divorced at the moment, and just the process of going to court every single day and having the case delayed, and just looking at the papers. I speak Arabic, so that's also much easier for me to be able to communicate and understand directly from Iraqis themselves without having to go with an interpreter to find out what's going on.
And you can hear and understand those little nuanced conversations about getting a divorce and how hard that's become. You know, Jamie, we've heard from an occasional listener when we have reporters on the air just returned from Iraq, Nir Rosen, for instance, we just had with us, and they say that reporters are unable to see the good stories. They're unable to see that good things are happening in Iraq. Do you feel, you know, by and large, that it is an entirely negative picture? Do you see positive stories? I mean, what is your sense?
It is difficult to see the complete picture. I know that we're only seeing parts of it. I would love to be able to go out and report more. I would love to be able to go out and see good news stories happening. A lot of the time when we try to go out to these reconstruction sites to go and visit and see what sort of work is being done, the people who are organizing the projects won't allow any kind of publicity because it attracts attacks from insurgents. Mm. So they want to keep that discreet and under the radar. I invite anyone who has issues with the way that we report to come to Baghdad and to see what it's like to actually move around there. I mean, you saw someone like Jill Carroll who was under the radar as possible, and she tried to go out and do those sorts of things, and you saw what happened to her. By and large, we're not getting this just from our own kind of imagination. What I do is I get this from Iraqis. I try to explain what is going on from the perspective of your everyday Iraqi. I would seriously love to be able to go out there and do all these wonderful, happy stories if I saw any.
Well, in fact, you've reported on the result of this constant drumbeat of negativity for the Iraqis, the ones who are living it. In a clip of a story we're about to hear, you reported on the increasing number of Iraqis suffering from psychological problems and the rise in substance abuse by those who are just trying to self-medicate. You spoke with a woman who'd become addicted to sleeping pills after watching the abduction of her best friend. She was beaten and raped as they walked to school together. Let's listen.
They could have let her out of the car, but they didn't. They took her away and they raped her. Four of them raped her. And she's so young.
I should finish and graduate, but my family wouldn't let me. They are afraid.
Rola began taking sleeping pills to get her through the nights when she was terrified someone would try to storm the house. Now she takes the pills to dull the restlessness and the pain.
The pills don't have any effect anymore because I take so many of them. I just want my day to finish.
Jamie Tarabay, how prevalent is that?
You know, one of the other people that we profiled for this story, and there was simply not enough room in the piece to give him enough of a space as we did Rola. was a 24-year-old man who was drinking himself to sleep and smoking. And, you know, alcohol under Islam is prohibited. And he basically was just drinking to overcome the loss of his best friend. The situation that's going on in Iraq right now is manifesting itself in all sorts of different ways. And the people that we spoke to, the hospitals that we went to, they all say that because it's not improving, because there is still violence every single day, people can't move on from it. It's still there in front of them. They can't put it aside or, you know, just think, okay, that happened, and now I'm going to focus on the future. Because as far as they're concerned, the future is as bad as it was. You know,
it keeps. It sounds like it's getting exponentially worse. It keeps adding problem on problem.
Yeah.
You visited a morgue. You've been reporting on the rise in business for specially trained Shiites who perform ritual washings of the dead before burial. And you spoke with a woman preparing corpses in Iraq. Let's listen.
She takes a bar of soap made of olive oil and rubs it in small circles on the woman's scalp, creating a lather. She takes a loofah and scrubs every inch of skin, every finger, and every toe. She's careful and caring.
One day they brought a body of a young woman who was in a burning car. She died holding tight to her baby.
Umar Abbas said it was impossible to separate the two corpses.
A mother is always a mother, even if she's dead.
Jamie Tarabay, President Bush, his allies, say that the new government, the forming of a new government, is going to turn the tide in Iraq. How are people reacting to what's so far been the formation of some of the new government?
Beyond indifferent. They waited and waited and waited. It's been more than 5 months. A lot of them risked so much just to go out into the street and vote, you know, on days when insurgents were threatening to wash the streets with the blood of people who went out to vote. And, you know, the first experience that they had of democracy was a corrupt government that was ineffectual, that wasn't able to stem the violence. And you know, it's been 5 months later, and all they see are these politicians jockeying for power. They see people still being killed, they see the electricity still being cut off, and they still see very, very long lines of cars lined up for gasoline. So it hasn't translated into any real results yet on the ground, and they're still waiting. A lot of them just think, whatever, you know, this isn't going to change anything on the ground at the moment.
NPR reporter Jamie Tarabay, she's been reporting from Iraq for the past 3 years. When we come back, we'll hear more about the division still tearing at that country and the expectation that it will only get worse before it gets better. Today, the Associated Press is reporting that a car bomb in the southern city of Hilla has killed at least 12 people. And U.S. military commanders are saying they're going to move about 1,500 combat troops from a reserve force in Kuwait into western Iraq in an attempt to help local authorities there establish order. Well, when we come back, more from Jamie on the problems that those troops will face. Much more ahead here and now. Talk with NPR reporter Jamie Tarabay, who spends 6 weeks in Iraq, 2 weeks out on a rotating basis. We sat down with her last week when she came through Boston, just back from Iraq, and we asked her what people are saying about the Iraqi security forces there.
Right now, people don't actually trust the security forces. They don't think that they have any credibility. They think that they're sectarian heavy. I think that mostly...
What does that mean?
Well, I think that the police in particular is dominated by Shiites, formerly of militias and Shiite political groups. And these are the guys who are being accused of running these death squads, going in, finding Sunni men. And, you know, we get every single day reports of bodies being dumped on highways, in cars, you know, blindfolded, hands tied, feet tied.
We should remind, for those who get confused in the politics here, the Shiites were formerly the majority, but under the thumb of Saddam Hussein and the Sunnis, and now the Shiites have flocked to vote. They are now in leadership positions, and some feel that these are reprisals.
Absolutely. The Sunnis are being blamed for largely making up the insurgency. They're trying to destabilize this incoming government as much as possible because they lost power. Only recently did they begin to join the political process, and even the ones that are are being accused by insurgents of betrayal.
So you're saying the Sunnis are being accused of being largely insurgents, but it's the Shiites who are behind some of these death squads?
Yeah, the ones who are in government. You've got these Sunni militia, the insurgents, and then you've also got the Shiite militia running under the cover of police forces. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, sometimes they set up fake checkpoints. And you could be driving down the street and they stop you at a checkpoint and they look at your ID card. They see that you're a Sunni, they take you and they kill you. Mm. Or it could be the complete reverse. 2 days before I left, there were 70 bodies in 6 hours just in Baghdad delivered to the morgue, all killed in this way, you know. So it's not reported because it happens all the time. It's almost expected. You ring Baghdad's morgue and they tell you, yes, we received these bodies today, and this number are unidentified, and this number was shot execution style. So that's what people see. You know, they come to the morgue to collect the bodies. You know, they don't know where their relatives are. People have gone missing.
Do you think that this fissure is going to be repairable, or do you think that, as some have suggested, there's ultimately going to have to be separate countries within this space?
Well, I think that some of the different factions within the Iraq favor federalism and independent states, particularly the Kurds. Mm-hmm. In terms of being able to get over everything that's going on now, I mean, I think that this is all sort of stuff that's happened as a result of the fall of the regime. You know, you had people for 30-odd years that weren't able to act against each other, that weren't allowed to do anything for themselves, and now finally, that's why there's a lot of revenge killings going on. It's going to take a lot of time. I think they have to go through this process. And, you know, you talk to Iraqis and they say a lot more people have to die before things begin to get better. They have to get a lot worse before they improve.
Do you come in contact with many of the U.S. military?
Yes, I do. I don't do a lot of embeds. What I mainly do is Baghdad and the Iraqi Baghdad more than any other kind of Baghdad. Mm. We do rely on the military a lot for assistance for transport. Like, for example, if I want to get down to Najaf, I'm not going to drive down because the roads are too dangerous. Mm-hmm. So I'll get a flight in on a helicopter.
The U.S. coalition forces, they're not a monolith, you know, but I'm wondering, what's your sense of them right now in this point in time?
Well, they've really retreated to their bases. They're barely on the streets. You know, when I first arrived in Baghdad in early 2003, we were standing in line with American soldiers at the Pizza Hut. They were outside. They felt like they didn't need to be that protected because the atmosphere around them was very congenial. I mean, people were very hospitable. And now it's just completely changed. It's completely different. If you see a U.S. military convoy on the street, you just get out of the way. You move as far away as possible because everybody's on alert. If you put one foot wrong, I mean, you could get killed, you could get shot at.
And they are hypersensitive and they're also a target.
Absolutely. You stay away from them because they could be targeted, and you stay away from them because if you do something that seems to them as a threat, that then they will target you. I'm sure they're as equally terrified as we are sometimes traveling in the streets of Iraq.
Well, given that, Jamie Terabay, I know you rotate in and out of the country 6 or 7 weeks in, a couple weeks out. Do you look forward to going back?
I do, actually. It's exhausting, it's tiring, it's relentless, but there's so much to do and there's so much going on, and I think it's important for us to keep telling the stories that we tell. And it's also, I just feel very connected to it now. I feel like it's in my system now and I have to kind of keep going back and I keep on checking. Even though I'm out now, I want to talk to everyone who's there still and see what's going on and see how everyone is. And yeah, it's not going away from me anytime soon either.
NPR reporter Jamie Terabay on a break from her work in Baghdad. Well, this week, as we've reported, a car bomb seriously injured CBS correspondent Kimberly Dozier and killed cameraman Paul Douglas and soundman James Brolin. Kimberly was a frequent guest on Here and Now, and in a conversation that now seems foreshadowing, she told us in October of 2004 of concerns about increased bombings after tons of explosives left over from Saddam Hussein's regime were left unguarded and raided.
They are enormous. It took tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers in Saddam's time to secure them. And after the war, when U.S. troops were pouring in here and trying to establish control, they simply didn't have enough troops to fight an insurgency, stop the looting on the streets, and protect hundreds, if not thousands, of acres of these vast weapons facilities. So essentially, if someone knew where something important was, they could help themselves to it. That is what Iraqi officials are afraid has happened with this stuff.
That's CBS reporter Camilla Dozier speaking to Here and Now from Iraq on October 25th, 2004. She is recovering from a car bombing in Germany. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR.
Dunkin' Donuts wants to make sure its customers know the people making the donuts are working legally. Several of the franchise's outlets have posted signs saying, "Our hiring policy is simple. We follow the law." The national fast food chain is taking part in a government pilot program that checks databases to make sure employees are in the United States legally. That program is voluntary now, with about 6,000 employers taking part. But recently passed Senate and House immigration bills contain provisions that would make the program mandatory for the country's 8 million employers. Joining us first with more on the program is Jerry Ratliff, chief of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Verification Program, the group that runs the pilot program. Jerry, can you explain how this program works?
Sure. Basically, employers who want to volunteer to participate just sign a memorandum of understanding with us to sign up for the program, mm-hmm. and then every time they hire a new worker, they electronically verify that person's work authorization status with our system.
We understand they do that over the phone or on the Internet.
It's on the Internet. It's a very simple transaction, just with some identifying information, someone's name, date of birth, etc. And within seconds, they will generally get back, both for their citizen workers and their non-citizen workers, information about either confirming that that person is work authorized, and obviously all U.S. citizens are work authorized, and that information is provided by the Social Security Administration. We also verify the Social Security number of the person, mm-hmm. and if there's any doubt about the validity of the information, we give the worker the benefit of the doubt. They can come in either to Social Security or to a USCIS office to straighten out whatever the problem might be.
And the employee, the employer rather, can't fire the employee until they receive a final notice from you confirming that the worker is ineligible. And at that time, when employers are allowed to fire employees because they are not here legally, do they then have to follow through and, you know, take them to some government office?
No. They just put in the system the outcome. If they terminated that person's employment, they just check that box in our system, and that's the end of it.
Okay. Well,
we're not asking the employer to be an enforcer.
Well, the Government Accountability Office, as you well know, has criticized the program because it doesn't catch identity fraud, that there are flaws in the database, and the system wrongly identifies about 2 to 3% of people as unverified. Now, if you're just working with, 6,000 employers now, that, of course, would be exponentially a much larger number when it goes wider?
Well, first of all, some of the reengineering we're doing now to make the system stronger, we're looking at a way to try to incorporate an identity check into the system. We're also working very hard to improve the data in the databases and to look at other Department of Homeland Security sources of data that would help us make sure an even higher percentage of people can be verified immediately.
Well, in a recent Washington Post article, the story was cited of a man who worked for mm-hmm. Tyson Foods in Chicago, mm-hmm. and he was fired because the system identified him as unverified, even though he was a citizen. He eventually got his job back after a reporter intervened, but that's just one story, Jerry, and I'm just wondering, if this goes nationwide, you're talking about millions of employees.
I'm glad you brought that up, because in that case, in that article, that was a case of an employer who did not follow our rules. If the employer does what we've asked them to do and use the system correctly, that would not have happened. When you get a tentative non-confirmation, the employer should not be firing the employee.
Jerry Ratliff is chief of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Verification Program, which is the basic pilot program that Dunkin' Donuts and other companies are using today to verify workers' legality. Jerry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to turn now to Tyler Morano of the National Immigration Law Center and Immigrants' Rights Group. And Tyler, Jerry just mentioned that perhaps an employer made an error. Does that concern you?
Well, in general, the notion that the basic pilot program is the cure-all that's going to defer employers from hiring undocumented workers is deeply flawed, particularly when there's no political will for meaningful enforcement of strong labor and employment laws. As you pointed out, the basic pilot's performance thus far has been spotty, and this is with a very small percentage of employers participating in the system. As you also point out, the GAO did a report pointing out the inaccuracies in the database. Jerry said that the system works if employers follow the rules. Well, we know that some employers don't follow the rules.
Well, but isn't it a problem, Tyler, that many employers also try to skirt existing law? We know that in the past, employers have simply had to, do a paper-based process in which they'd examine workers' documentation. And we've talked to employers who said, how do I know? They've got the form, and it looks good to me. And other employers are just as happy to sort of encourage employees to forge things. So the government has been sort of powerless to do anything. Doesn't the government need something to enforce law?
Well, that's just the point I'm trying to make, is that when you don't have meaningful enforcement of labor and employment law, you're not going to be able to solve the worksite enforcement problem, because what employers do is, let's say the basic pilot, they don't put the immigrant generally through the system. The immigrant asserts his or her labor rights. They put them through the basic pilot system so they can then fire them. We also know that employers have used the basic pilot program to pre-screen workers, which is against the law. They're not allowed to do it. But there's no enforcement mechanism to punish employers who use the basic pilot system improperly.
We should be clear, they're not allowed to use the system prior to hiring someone.
Exactly. And that is what some unscrupulous employers do. Not all employers, but some do. And so I think the real point here is that, we're working in this little microcosm of, I think, approximately 6,000 employers. But if we look at the House and Senate bills, that we can expand this to every single employer and every single worker in the country. We are kidding ourselves that this is going to be sort of implemented smoothly.
Well, Dunkin' Donuts has said that the reason that they're doing this program is that customers have complained to them. They've had people coming up and assuming, especially if the employees don't speak English, that they might be illegal immigrants.
Well, perhaps they're doing that for PR purposes, but there's a law in place that requires Dunkin' Donuts to verify that each and every worker is, in fact, who they say that they are and that they're work authorized. So, it's against the law to assume that someone isn't work authorized just based on the way they speak or the way they look. And so, I'm not sure what Dunkin' Donuts is gaining. There's already a law in place.
Does Dunkin' Donuts' concern, though, speak to a wider concern on the part of Americans? They want to be insured of this.
The basic pilot program, as I stated earlier, doesn't. It's just an electronic system versus a paper system, and what it's doing, I guess, the flip side is every worker in this country essentially has to ask the Department of Homeland Security for permission to work. And with the inaccuracies in the databases, I think we're going to see more people who are authorized to work who are being identified as unauthorized. And whether that's the U.S. citizen in Chicago or the U.S. citizen in Boston, we're going to have people who are not going to be able to get jobs because of the mistakes in the system.
Tyler Moran of the National Immigration Law Center and Immigrants' Rights Group. Tyler, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Still to come, she was Julia Child's executive chef. Now, Nancy Verdi Barr is a novelist, and her main character seems a lot like, well, you know who. You're listening to Here and Now. I've had a cell phone for years, and I have no idea how to use it beyond making and receiving a call. A friend recently bought a Prius, and I can't figure out how to turn on the air or the heat or the radio. And don't get me started on the DVD player. Well, now it seems there's a term for this. It's called feature fatigue. Joining us on the line is Rebecca Hamilton. She's assistant professor of marketing at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. She reported on her research in a recent Harvard Business Review article about feature fatigue and how to defeat it. Rebecca, glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Actually, you've entered two new phrases into the lexicon, feature bloat and feature fatigue. One's the result of the other. What are they?
Well, feature fatigue is consumers' desire for lots and lots of features before they actually use a product. And then what happens is when they get the product home, often there's a shift in their preferences, so they wish they hadn't chosen so many features. They're
right.
Simply overwhelmed. So, you know, I think this phenomenon is partially encouraged by consumers themselves who are attracted to all these features.
And I just want to ask you personally, how did you all begin to do this research? Why did you come up with this study?
Well, we had some personal experience with this. Actually, Roland, my co-author, Roland Rust, received a mouse pad from a company. And this mouse pad was pretty elaborate. It had a radio in it, a clock, it had batteries, it came with an instruction manual. He brought this into my office and said, Rebecca, look at this. And we started talking about it, and one of the things we started thinking about was, well, maybe consumers actually want this, and what if consumers change their minds over time?
Right, well, because what happens, I mean, when people get home and realize they didn't want those 10 bells and whistles on their cell phone, for instance, what do they do?
Well, there are a lot of coping mechanisms, we call them, for consumers. You know, there can be frustration. There can be some people who sit down and look at the instruction manual and really master it. So there's mastery is one thing that can happen, or simply putting the product away.
Can you give us some examples that you came across of, bloat and fatigue? I loved the examples you gave in cars. For instance, the BMW, so many features that some valet parkers couldn't park the car.
Well, and you think a car is something that should be relatively intuitive. You've driven enough cars in your lifetime, but certainly the system has given a lot of people pause. And it sounds like BMW sales are down for this series.
This
so
is the
it may or may not be cause in effect.
The 7 Series cars.
Yes.
But also you give the example of a Mercedes. Within the key to the Mercedes, you can put the seat adjustment information.
Mm-hmm.
It'll keep the memory of how your seat is supposed to be. But if, for instance, a husband and wife were sharing a car and he grabbed the wrong key, then he couldn't change the seat from her adjustment.
Well, I think computer chips themselves, because they're so inexpensive, are part of the reason we're seeing this. Having the ability to do this cheaply, you know, makes it all the more tantalizing for the manufacturers and engineers.
You know, I wonder, is this, Rebecca, just a generational thing? I mean, are there younger people, 20s, teens, who actually are not having problems with things?
Well, actually, there is some evidence. There's the National Technology Readiness Survey, for example, that suggests that people encounter these problems more as they get older. But all of our studies were actually done with college students, and we found that even they had this problem. And in fact, we didn't find any differences between experts and novices in these product categories. So even people who were very familiar with these products, used them all the time, wanted lots of features before they used them, and yet when they got into it, they were actually more satisfied with fewer features.
Right. Which is why you point out the iPod is so successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a product that clearly does one thing and does one thing well, and the controls are very intuitive. There are just a few controls. There are a few things you can do with it. I mean, it's almost like a garage door opener. You press one button, the door goes up. You press the same button, it goes down if it's already up. I mean, how could it be simpler? I think there are some products that really illustrate how products perhaps should be.
Right. Well, Rebecca Hamilton, I have just one last thing to say to you. God bless you.
We'll hope some of this gets through.
Right. Rebecca Hamilton, assistant professor of marketing at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland, and co-author of an article in the Harvard Business Review about her study on feature bloat and feature fatigue, both of which I'm suffering. Rebecca, thanks.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. the new novel, Last Bite, heroine Casey Costello is trying to juggle mystery, romance, and occasionally eggs in her incredibly demanding job as an executive chef working on a morning television show whose food star, Sally Woods, is the grande dame of the culinary world.
Sally has been the biggest cheese in the food world for nearly 30 years. She has been declared a legend and a national treasure, been dined and feted by three presidents of the United States and one in France, and granted diplomas and awards more times than anyone can count, including Sally, who doesn't pay a whole lot of attention to such things. The man in the street knows her. Children barely old enough to use a stove ask for her autograph. Foodies swoon over her.
Sound like anyone you know?
Welcome to the French Chef. I'm Julia Child.
The resemblance is more than coincidence. Author Nancy Verdi Barr was executive chef to Julia Child for 8 years. Now she's concocted the culinary novel Last Bite, and she joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me here, Robin.
So, Nancy, of course, knowing you worked with Julia for, what, 18 years?
18 years.
One reads this wondering how much is true. Did you really have to give Julia the Heimlich because she put hot caramel in her mouth?
Oh, she did put hot caramel in her mouth. Not exactly as it happened in the book. But since I was writing a food novel that happened in television, it was really impossible to keep my memories of what it was like with Julia out of it. Some of the things are pure fiction. Some of them are borrowed of what happened in a fictional way.
Well, for instance, did fans really ask Julia Child for her autograph while she was in a stall in a public bathroom?
Oh, that did happen in Memphis, Tennessee, for sure. She gave it to them.
How else is Sally Woods, the character in the book, like Julia Child?
Her spirit is very much like Julia's. Sally in the book is always tasting something. That was one of the problems we'd have on a set if we were fixing something that had to be cooked. We had to keep Julia's hand out of it. She was first and foremost a foodie.
Well, Casey Costello is the character, I assume, shaped after yourself. She works for...
I wish.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you had some fun there with some of her relationships with other chefs. But she did work on a morning show, much like you worked on Good Morning America.
Yes, yes. That's how the book evolved, was using my experiences.
Well, back to the storyline. There's a mystery surrounding Sally, your Julia-esque character. She has a disreputable manager who seems to be making poor career choices for her. And she also... has some thoughts not entirely positive about her devoted and recently deceased husband. Now, we rush to say that in real life, Julia Child adored her husband, Paul.
She did. And that was very, as I was developing the mystery of that, at first it was very hard for me to make Sally Woods' husband have this problem that Sally discovers after he's gone, because I adored Paul Child. He was wonderful. But I had to keep telling myself, it's not Julia, it's Sally Woods, and it's not Paul. I needed some type of intrigue going on, and I love spy mystery things.
Well, in fact, it does, we won't give it away, but it does revolve around a spy storyline. And, you know, people used to think that Julia Child was a spy because she worked for the OSS prior to becoming a chef.
She did indeed, and she always said she wanted to be a spy, but she was too tall. They wouldn't take her. But Julia and I used to lend each other spy novels all the time and mysteries. It was a passion we shared. So I couldn't avoid or couldn't resist putting in a little bit of a spy.
So there's mystery, but there's also romance. I mean, the subtitle of the book is A Novel of Culinary Romance, and the romance is between sort of your character, the assistant, Casey Costello, and Irish star chef Danny O'Shea. Oh, please, too good to be true. He's beautiful. He cooks.
I think about Casey Costello being me, and I think I should have been so lucky. Danny O'Shea, I just loved writing about him. He becomes a love interest, or at least he's interested in Casey. I won't let you know if it becomes a love interest. But the name of the book, Last Bite, comes from a quote from Francois Minot, the editor of Guy Michelin, and he says, anybody can make you enjoy the first bite of a dish, but only a real chef can make you enjoy the last. So I guess you have to guess whether Casey enjoys the last bite with a chef or not.
What was it like for 18 years? I mean, you share some of it in the book. You say, for instance, your character, again, the executive chef for Julia Child, sort of helping her do all her cooking segments. the other chefs were always kind of, you know, cozying up to you, and you never knew if it was for you or because they were trying to get close to Julia. That's one thing. What else was it like to be around Julia Child?
Very quickly after getting to know Julia, you realize that she's so down to earth, Robin, that you forget that she's someone. As a matter of fact, I can remember going into a hotel in Dallas where they had given us the presidential suite, and I don't know if you've ever stayed in one,
no.
But they are enormous. A dining rooms that go on forever with tables fully set, grand piano. And I walked in and I said, gee, Julia, I had no idea you were so special. She said, neither did I, you know, and she really didn't.
Well, and you were also the one responsible for helping her do her on-camera cooking segments. And, well, hilarity often ensued. She was everything that people thought was sort of a caricature of Julia Child was true. She did drop things. She'd stick her finger in something. You talked about having to keep her away from things.
Yes. Well, with the caramel incident that happens in this book, the real incident, she was actually on camera. We were shooting. She was stirring a caramel. And for some reason, she put that spoon in her mouth. And then she
Hot was it?
It was melting caramel. It was extremely hot. So she's saying, well, now you want your caramel. And nobody could understand what she was saying. And finally, the director yelled down, cut. He said, Julia, I'm having a bit of difficulty understanding. So my mouth was stuck together. And she pulled out caramel, and she'd actually burned her mouth. But, yeah, she was, you never knew what she was going to do. The interesting thing is, the joyous thing, is that if she did something live, she could cover for it. She was unflappable. Nothing threw her.
Tell us of a segment like, for instance, on Good Morning America, where you're standing on the sideline with your team, because it's a team of people.
Oh, definitely.
To put
a team
these segments
people
on. You've got to cook every single step of the actual cooking and then also have a final product. Can you remember a moment where it just sort of all went south?
She was doing a Baked Alaska segment with David Hartman, and Julia loved that blowtorch. Oh, you know, that was long before these little tiny ones they use in the kitchen now. She had a great big one, and she pulled out the blowtorch, and of course it wouldn't light. And David Hartman tried to light it. So she just took the liquor, poured it all over the Baked Alaska anyway, and served it to David. I thought he was going to pass out drunk the minute he did. And she's eating. She said, well, it's quite good this way. Anyway, that's why in the book I did have the Sally Woods, the Julia character, if you want, and the chef on do a Baked Alaska, because it was such a wonderful spot. It really was.
Nancy Vertibar's book is Last Bite, a novel of culinary romance. You're just wondering, too, Nancy, of course, Julia's now gone. We all miss her. But in a way, this book sort of keeps her alive.
Thank you for saying that. It certainly did for me writing it, Robin. It made it flow so easily because I had that image of what it was like to work with a character, and she definitely kept her alive in my mind.
And she was a character.
She was a character. She was unique. People, I hear people all the time saying, oh, so-and-so's going to be the next Julia Child. And I'm thinking, no, a person like that comes along once every 100 years or so, because it was more than the fact that she was a dedicated cooking teacher and knew what she was doing and was a personality. There are so many aspects of Julia that made her truly special.
Nancy, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And for listeners here in our Boston area, Nancy Vertibar, author of Last Bite, a novel of culinary romance, will be giving a cooking demonstration this Saturday at the Cambridge School of Culinary Arts here in Cambridge, where Julia lived and was loved for decades. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the new